is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The impact of armed conflicts on the people of the DRC is deep and increasing. Several reports point to incidents that may amount to war crimes or crimes against humanity.
That's the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, on the horrific toll armed conflicts are taking on the civilian population in the DRC. Details coming up. Also, rival factions in Libya have reached an initial agreement on security and military issues. And a U.S.-backed Zimbabwean charity is helping farmers to improve the quality and quantity of their yields. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Representatives of Libya's rival factions have reached an initial agreement on security and military issues, but talks on the political side appear to be stymied. The United Nations Support Mission for Libya said in a statement that discussions in the Egyptian city of Hurghada between delegations representing the GNA government and LNA reviewed the security arrangements, which would be determined at a late stage. However, the second round of political dialogue between the two sides in Morocco was postponed several times this week without a date of resumption. A conflict of agenda between the two sides seems to be the reason. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed these developments with Wolfgang Poshtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya.
The discussion about security arrangements for Sirte, the oil industry, and finally about the unification of Libyan armed forces that took place in Hurghada was certainly a positive step and will have a positive influence on the political dialogue. Although the outcome was just a series of recommendations and some confidence-building measures, including an exchange of prisoners of war until the end of October, and most important, to continue with these talks in the lead-up to the 5+5 meetings in Geneva. So altogether, the talks were certainly useful on the way to Geneva and also on the way to the political dialogue, although not the same people will meet in Geneva, and although there is the key question, if those who represented the GNA and its affiliated militias really have the mandate to do so. So we will see, nevertheless, a positive step.
The second round of political dialogue between the two sides in Morocco was postponed several times this week without scheduling a future date to resume. How do you explain the lack of progress on the political track?
With regard to the talks in Morocco, there is not only a conflict of agendas between the Libyan parties, but also a conflict within the two sides, so within the Supreme State Council and within the House of Representatives. Actually, the various factions of the Supreme State Council, although most of them are Islamist or Islamist-leaning, are far from being united. Several of them are actually challenging the mandate of those who are in Morocco for the first round of the discussion. It's quite similar within the House of Representatives. There are more or less two groups. There is one group fully aligned with Marshall Heftar and his LNA, and those leaning towards Aguila Saleh. On the other side, as we have seen with the Shkirat Agreement and the negotiations to the Shkirat Agreement, and especially the subsequent mess, it does not make any sense to have negotiations or an agreement between dialogue partners who don't have the mandate and the trust of those who are there representing. So it makes much more sense to take a little bit more time and wait and continue with serious negotiations only when both sides are ready. Hopefully, and due to the international pressure on both sides, this will be the case until mid-October, when the Geneva talks are about to start. The House of Representatives and the Supreme State Council could have a key role with regard to the outcome of the talks in Geneva, because they could provide legitimacy to it.
News reports said that military forces loyal to the GNA in Sirte rejected any deal with General Haftar and said any Libyan dialogue should be based only on a referendum, on a constitution, and holding elections. What would that mean for reaching a political solution in Libya?
I doubt that countrywide elections at the current moment would make much sense, as the political process just has restarted, and also keeping in mind that the country is not ready for elections. I think deciding for elections right now would just lead to a longer break in the political process. And a referendum on the constitutional draft from 2017 is also not a good idea. Why? The draft is a very weak and vague compromise. I doubt that the outcome of the referendum would be fair, and I doubt that the outcome would be fully accepted by everyone. So I doubt that the referendum would lead to a constitution widely accepted in Libya. The second point is probably even more important, that this draft does not allow for a decentralized stabilization of Libya. But from my point of view, a decentralized stabilization of Libya is the only one realistic way forward. Much better would be right now the continuation of the political process, especially agreeing on a three-member presidential council, one member from Tripolitania, one from Cyrenaica Barca, and one member from Bezan, and subsequently the adoption of the old federalist constitution of Libya as an interim, and let me stress, not as a final, as an interim tool.
That was Wolfgang Poschdai from Austrian military attaché. Repeat. That was Wolfgang Poschdai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. A new UN report links continued armed conflicts and widespread impunity in Democratic Republic of Congo to massive human rights violations. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA in Geneva on the report, which has been submitted to the UN Human Rights Council.
In presenting the report of her office, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, expressed dismay and alarm at the horrific toll armed conflicts are taking on the civilian population in the DRC. While North Kivu, South Kivu, and Ituri provinces are particularly affected by conflict, she says violence also continues in Maniema, Kasai, Kasai Central, and Tanganyika provinces.
As the report documents, the impact of armed conflicts on the people of the DRC is deep and increasing. Several reports point to incidents that may amount to war crimes or crimes against humanity. Armed groups are largely responsible for the considerable increase in violations and abuses recorded by my office.
Eastern Congo, in particular, has been racked with violence for years as various groups compete for control of rich mining areas. Bachelet says her office has recorded a monthly average of 704 violations in Congo, a sharp increase from last year's monthly average of 548. She says violence and fear have displaced some 5.5 million people and forced more than 900,000 to flee to other African countries for refuge. The report also documents widespread violations of civil and political rights throughout the country. It finds human rights defenders and journalists are subject to threats, arbitrary detentions, harassment, and they also are subject to increasing human rights violations and abuses. It documents rising sexual violence against women and girls. Bachelet calls for an end to impunity. She says perpetrators of these crimes must be held accountable. She adds, victims must receive justice and be recompensed for their suffering. DRC Minister of Human Rights André Lit Asbeya acknowledges the need to combat impunity, serious crimes, and corruption at all levels. He says his government is engaged in doing just that. He speaks through an interpreter.
And we have considerable capacities here. We want to rationalize and ensure that we can build a much better DRC with human rights fully respected.
Asabeya says the Congolese state intends to continue this effort until the difficulties have been considerably reduced and the working conditions for the judiciary have been improved. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A U.S.-backed Zimbabwean charity is helping small farmers improve the quality and quantity of their yields to increase their income and bolster food security. Feed the Future Zimbabwe says small farms make up 70% of Zimbabwe's farmers, and making them more efficient could help restore the country's lost status as Africa's breadbasket. Columbus Mavunga reports from Chiramanzu, Zimbabwe.
It's a tale of two ways of life in Rusununguko village in Chirumanz district, about 200 kilometers south of Harare. Life for the have and the have-nots in this arid area. Those who have utilities like electricity and running water attribute it to dairy farming. That's the story for 8-year-old Felistas Shorai Kwadipedza. She started her farm about 5 years ago, thanks to Feed the Future Zimbabwe. Now she sells milk to a company listed on the Zimbabwe Stock Exchange and is able to look after her orphaned grandchildren. In my life, she said, there has been change since I started dairy farming. I never used to get money. Look at how old I am, she said. I lost a daughter, a mother of two. I look after them. I have bought stuff such as plow for my home to thrive. Feed the Future Zimbabwe is a local non-governmental organization funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development. The group says it has empowered more than 13,000 smallholder farmers over the past 5 years. Kudakwashe Ndoro says his organization trains farmers on how to improve product quality and yields while holding down costs and ultimately making the country more food secure.
When the government is giving inputs, the farmer must also have something substantial which he has to be putting in, not just receiving. If a donor is coming in with a program or a project, something substantial has to be invested by the farmer, which we can call co-invested, not just what we are seeing where people might be called to say, okay, put up a road, do this food for work. No, that's not enough.
The Zimbabwe government says smallholder farmers have an important role to play in the country's economy and will be the target of a government initiative to give them the seeds and fertilizer they need. Vangelis Peter Haritotos is Zimbabwe's junior agriculture minister.
The smallholder farmers are critical in this whole equation of food security. We're targeting 1.8 million households. And what we're looking at that 1.8 million is we're looking at 1.8 million metric tons of cereal crops and 360,000 metric tons of oil seeds. So in the high rainfall areas, we'll be distributing maize and soya beans for the oil seeds. The lower should we say, rain areas, we'll be distributing traditional grains such as sorghum, for example, and as well as sunflower.
With this initiative, training from Feed the Future Zimbabwe and a forecast of a favorable rainy season ahead, farmers are hoping this year, after two decades, Zimbabwe will begin to regain its status as the breadbasket of Southern Africa. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
There was confusion at the border after South Africa said it would start allowing ordinary travelers and traders to cross yesterday as it eases COVID-19 rules. But Zimbabwe kept its side closed, stranding and frustrating people. Arigando gives us more on the story.
Home Affairs and Cultural Heritage Minister Kazembe Kazembe said Zimbabwe has only opened international airports to passenger traffic with land borders remaining closed. Zimbabwe's land borders were closed on 20 March to help halt the spread of COVID-19. Zimbabwe, which heavily relies on manufactured goods from South Africa, its largest trade partner, has only been allowing commercial traffic, diplomats and returning residents to cross. Immigration officials say that since March, 9,331 Zimbabweans have passed through the Beitbridge border post and were given COVID-19 tests and quarantined in provincial centers. While the ministry maintains that the government is following its public health protocols for the pandemic, local residents worry about both the virus and the economy. The director of the Bulawayo Vendors and Traders Association, Mike Ondiweni, whose members rely on cross-border trading, says the continued closure is unfair and counterproductive to government efforts to curb the pandemic spread.
As we saw, some ICPTs, informal cross-border traders, have been illegally using those illegal exit points to go and buy stuff in South Africa. In Messina, to be specific, some were claiming that they are sick, they're going to buy medication. So even if the government doesn't open the border, people still continue crossing. And this poses a threat in terms of people coming with the disease without the government actually knowing. And for women, it exposes them to a potential rape, abuse, losing of whatever they will have bought. So
the way is that the government should at least control and test those crossing the borders. A number of Zimbabweans who said they were heading home after being caught up in South Africa's tight COVID-19 rules were turned back at the border, some after traveling all night to cross. Ngabuto Nicholas Mabena, chairman of the Zimbabwe community in South Africa, says his members are suffering from a lack of communication and coordination between the two nations.
So if South Africa resolves on the opening of the Bedbridge border post or the Musina side of the border post on their side, but the Zimbabwe border post remain closed, it causes confusion. So our view is that the two governments must engage each other and agree on the opening of these borders.
Because South Africa's opening of the border yesterday had anticipation running high among Zimbabweans who thought ordinary traffic would be allowed. The government says its regulations remain in place and that the screening process will be costly. Some residents agree the borders shouldn't be open just yet. Businlovu, a Bulawayo entrepreneur, says she feels sorry for those who depend on basics such as food and affordable medicine from South Africa, but that she sees the need for caution.
When you come to think of it, we have our own problems, we have our own limitations, and probably government understands the challenge it would have in dealing with an influx of COVID cases coming in from South Africa. Given that people have been going in and out of South Africa using illegal methods anyway, but imagine if this means opening it up to everyone legally, it would mean that there's lesser controls of the infections, because most of our infections were coming in from that country anyway.
Still, aid agencies say Zimbabwe, already facing economic crisis on several fronts, is in dire need of most basics. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Survivors and their families are pushing for a special UN tribunal in Tanzania to act quickly in trying elderly tycoon Felician Kabuga on charges of financing the 1994 Rwandan genocide. France's top civil court ruled Wednesday that he could be handed over for prosecution. Kabuga was arrested in Paris in May after a manhunt that played out over a quarter century. He is accused of financing ethnic Hutu militias who killed hundreds of thousands of Tutsis and moderate Hutus during a 100-day period in 1994. But the tribunal in Arusha, Tanzania, will face legal challenges and bureaucratic delays as it prepares for trial. Kabuga's lawyers say he is too frail to extradite. International Edition's Laurie London speaks to Richard Gisagara, attorney with the Rwanda Community Association in France, about survivors and their families' reaction to the Paris court's decision to extradite.
Much pleased by the court ruling. I must say that I'm not really that surprised. I have always been positive, thinking that the decision is going to be good. But, you know, there is always a risk of, even though that you think that you are right, that you have the rights are on your side, sometimes you may have a bad surprise. But I was always positive, so I was not that much surprised by the court ruling. But on the other hand, as a lawyer and also as someone who is interested in humanity, we consider that like the beginning of the end of the impunity that that man has benefited from more than 26 years now. But there is a worry now. We are worried, first, because he's going to be handed in 1 month to the international justice, the mechanism. The problem is that with the experience we have with this mechanism, the International Tribunal for Rwanda has always been long in the rendering decisions. Dossier hearing takes really long time. And now we are worried that because Kabuga is an old man now, even though I think that he pretends that he's more old than he is, and his health also have some problems, even though I continue to think that also that he somehow exaggerated exaggerate also. But the fact is that he's old and that his health is not the way it used to be a long time ago. So we are worried that if the process takes as long time as it used to be, maybe he will pass away without rendering account to the humanity. So that's the first worry I have. On the other hand, also, I have some regret because the international justice, who have now the duty of rendering the justice with Kabuga, who is a big fish when you talk about genocide, it's going to be in a court which doesn't give any room to the victims. You know, the international justice, it's only the case going to be between Kabuga and his team of lawyers against the prosecutor. So the victims doesn't have any room in this kind of, in the international justice. So that's also some regret that I have. I would have wished that be judged in Rwanda, for instance, or in other country where the victims can have room, like the word to say. Hmm. But that's a really minor regret that I have.
So your ultimate wish would have been to have this case tried in Rwanda. But yeah. If not there, you obviously feel this is better than in France. Why was he trying so hard to keep it in France?
I didn't want him to be judged in France. Either in Rwanda, either in Arusha. Because in France, I know, I am really familiar with the French justice now. It is also as long as the international justice. So I'm sure that if the case was handed to France, he will not be judged before at least 5 years. So now the international justice have a big file already, even though some are worried about the time it will take, but they are more advanced than the French justice. Mm. So it's better that he be judged in international justice or rather than in France.
Any other reaction from survivors, victims that you have spoken to since this decision?
They are all of them are, they welcome that decision because, you know, justice is a big step for reconstruction of victims. They all need justice. Now, some may feel now we're more than 20 years after the fact, after the genocide. Some think that they have been forgotten. Some others also are worried, thinking that these people, these big fish, you know, you don't have many big fish who have been judged. So they were afraid, saying that they will never see justice for these big fishes. But the case of Kabuga, this is giving them hope. Now they think that maybe it's not too late. That's really very good. That's a hope which is given to the victims. Some have this kind of discouragement, thinking that it's too late now for having justice. But with this case, they have seen that it will never be late, that the justice, the criminal against humanity is not prescriptible. This is a fact which comes to show that it's a reality, that the non-prescription of crime against humanity is a fact. On the other hand, also is a hope also for people like us who are working hard so that all these people be accountable to what they have done. This is also showing us that even after 25 years, we can get results. So this is encouraging us to continue to do what we do, because if a person like Kabuga, who was rich, has been arrested, then we can think that also other people who are less powerful than Kabuga may also be arrested, maybe after 30 years, even after 50 years.
That was Richard Gisagara, attorney with the Rwanda Community Association in France, speaking with International Edition's Laurie London. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.